Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond continued. Cassette 2, Side 1. Whereas the extinctions took place probably before 30,000 years ago in Australia, they occurred around 17,000 to 12,000 years ago in the Americas. For those extinct American mammals whose bones are available in greatest abundance and have been dated especially accurately, one can pinpoint the extinctions as having occurred around 11,000 BC. Perhaps the two most accurately dated extinctions are those of the Shasta ground sloth and Harrington's mountain goat in the Grand Canyon area. Both of those populations disappeared within a century or two of 11,100 BC. Whether coincidentally or not, that date is identical, within experimental error, to the date of Clovis Hunter's arrival in the Grand Canyon area. The discovery of numerous skeletons of mammoths with Clovis spear points between their ribs suggests that this agreement of dates is not a coincidence. Hunters expanding southward through the Americas, encountering big animals that had never seen humans before, may have found those American animals easy to kill and may have exterminated them. A counter theory is that America's big mammals instead became extinct because of climate changes at the end of the last ice age, which, to confuse the interpretation for modern paleontologists, also happened around 11,000 BC. Personally, I have the same problem with a climatic theory of megafaunal extinction in the Americas as with such a theory in Australia and New Guinea. The Americas' big animals had already survived the ends of 22 previous ice ages. Why did most of them pick the 23rd to expire in concert, in the presence of all those supposedly harmless humans? Why did they disappear in all habitats, not only in habitats that contracted, but also in ones that greatly expanded at the end of the last ice age? Hence, I suspect that Clovis hunters did it, but the debate remains unresolved. Whichever theory proves correct, most large wild mammal species that might otherwise have later been domesticated by Native Americans were thereby removed. Also unresolved is the question whether Clovis hunters really were the first Americans. As always happens whenever anyone claims the first anything, claims of discoveries of pre-Clovis human sites in the Americas are constantly being advanced. Every year, a few of those new claims really do appear convincing and exciting when initially announced. Then the inevitable problems of interpretation arise. Were the reported tools at the site really tools made by humans, or just natural rock shapes? Are the reported radiocarbon dates really correct, and not invalidated by any of the numerous difficulties that can plague radiocarbon dating? If the dates are correct, are they really associated with human products, rather than just being a 15,000-year-old lump of charcoal lying next to a stone tool actually made 9,000 years ago? To illustrate these problems, consider the following typical example of an oft-quoted pre-Clovis claim. At a Brazilian rock shelter named Pedro Ferrada, archaeologists found cave paintings undoubtedly made by humans. They also discovered, among the piles of stones at the base of a cliff, some stones whose shapes suggested the possibility of their being crude tools. In addition, they came upon supposed hearths, whose burnt charcoal yielded radiocarbon dates of around 35,000 years ago. Articles on Pedro Ferrada were accepted for publication in the prestigious and highly selective international scientific journal Nature. But none of those rocks at the base of the cliff is an obviously human-made tool, as are Clovis points and Cro-Magnon tools. If hundreds of thousands of rocks fall from a high cliff over the course of tens of thousands of years, many of them will become chipped and broken when they hit the rocks below, and some will come to resemble crude tools chipped and broken by humans. In Western Europe and elsewhere in Amazonia, archaeologists have radiocarbon dated the actual pigments used in cave paintings. But that was not done at Pedro Ferrada. Forest fires occur frequently in the vicinity and produce charcoal that is regularly swept into caves by wind and streams. No evidence links the 35,000-year-old charcoal to the undoubted cave paintings at Pedro Ferrada. Although the original excavators remain convinced, a team of archaeologists who were not involved in the excavation but receptive to pre-Clovis claims recently visited the site and came away unconvinced. The North American site that currently enjoys the strongest credentials as a possible pre-Clovis site is Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Pennsylvania. yielding reported human-associated radiocarbon dates of about 16,000 years ago. At Meadowcroft, no archaeologist denies that many human artifacts do occur in many carefully excavated layers. But the oldest radiocarbon dates don't make sense, because the plant and animal species associated with them are species living in Pennsylvania in recent times of mild climates, rather than species expected for the glacial times of 16,000 years ago. Hence, one has to suspect that the charcoal samples dated from the oldest human occupation levels consist of post-Clovis charcoal infiltrated with older carbon. The strongest pre-Clovis candidate in South America is the Monte Verde site in southern Chile, dated to at least 15,000 years ago. It, too, now seems convincing to many archaeologists, but caution is warranted in view of all the previous disillusionments. If there really were pre-Clovis people in the Americas, why is it still so hard to prove that they existed? Archaeologists have excavated hundreds of American sites unequivocally dating to between 2000 and 11,000 BC, including dozens of Clovis sites in the North American West, rock shelters in the Appalachians, and sites in coastal California. Below all the archaeological layers with undoubted human presence, at many of those same sites, deeper, older layers have been excavated and still yield undoubted remains of animals, but with no further evidence of humans. The weaknesses in pre-Clovis evidence in the Americas contrast with the strength of the evidence in Europe, where hundreds of sites attest to the presence of modern humans long before Clovis hunters appeared in the Americas around 11,000 BC. Even more striking is the evidence from Australia and New Guinea, where there are barely one-tenth as many archaeologists as in the United States alone, but where those few archaeologists have nevertheless discovered over 100 unequivocal pre-Clovis sites scattered over the whole continent. Early humans certainly didn't fly by helicopter from Alaska to Meadowcroft and Monte Verde, skipping all the landscape in between. Advocates of pre-Clovis settlements suggest that, for thousands or even tens of thousands of years, pre-Clovis humans remained at low population densities or poorly visible archaeologically for unknown reasons unprecedented elsewhere in the world. I find that suggestion infinitely more implausible than the suggestion that Monte Verde and Meadowcroft will eventually be reinterpreted, as have other claimed pre-Clovis sites. My feeling is that if there really had been pre-Clovis settlement in the Americas, it would have become obvious at many locations by now, and we would not still be arguing. However, archaeologists remain divided on these questions. The consequences for our understanding of later American prehistory remain the same, whichever interpretation proves correct. Either the Americas were first settled around 11,000 BC and quickly filled up with people, or else the first settlement occurred somewhat earlier, most advocates of pre-Clovis settlement would suggest by 15,000 or 20,000 years ago, possibly 30,000 years ago, and few would seriously claim earlier. But those pre-Clovis settlers remained few in numbers, or inconspicuous, or had little impact until around 11,000 BC. In either case, of the five habitable continents, North America and South America are the ones with the shortest human prehistories. With the occupation of the Americas, most habitable areas of the continents and continental islands, plus oceanic islands from Indonesia to east of New Guinea, supported humans. The settlement of the world's remaining islands was not completed until modern times. Mediterranean islands, such as Crete, Cyprus, Corsica, and Sardinia, between about 8500 and 4000 BC. Caribbean islands, beginning around 4000 BC. Polynesian and Micronesian islands between 1200 BC and AD 1000. Madagascar, sometime between AD 300 and 800. And Iceland, in the 9th century AD. Native Americans, possibly ancestral to the modern Inuit, spread throughout the high Arctic around 2000 BC. That left as the sole uninhabited areas awaiting European explorers over the last 700 years, only the most remote islands of the Atlantic and Indian Oceans, such as the Azores and Seychelles, plus Antarctica. What significance, if any, do the continent's differing dates of settlement have for subsequent history? Suppose that a time machine could have transported an archaeologist back in time for a world tour at around 11,000 BC. Given the state of the world then, could the archaeologist have predicted the sequence in which human societies on the various continents would develop guns, germs, and steel, and thus predicted the state of the world today? Our archaeologist might have considered the possible advantages of a head start. If that counted for anything, then Africa enjoyed an enormous advantage. At least 5 million more years of separate proto-human existence than on any other continent. In addition, if it is true that modern humans arose in Africa around 100,000 years ago and spread to other continents, that would have wiped out any advantages accumulated elsewhere in the meantime and given Africans a new head start. Furthermore, human genetic diversity is highest in Africa. Perhaps more diverse humans would collectively produce more diverse inventions. But our archaeologist might then reflect, what really does a head start mean for the purposes of this book? We cannot take the metaphor of a foot race literally. If by head start you mean the time required to populate a continent after the arrival of the first few pioneering colonists, that time is relatively brief, for example, less than 1,000 years to fill up even the whole new world. If by head start you instead mean the time required to adapt to local conditions, I grant that some extreme environments did take time, for instance, 9,000 years to occupy the high Arctic after the occupation of the rest of North America, but people would have explored and adapted to most other areas quickly, once modern human inventiveness had developed. For example, after the ancestors of the Maori reached New Zealand, it apparently took them barely a century to discover all worthwhile stone sources, only a few more centuries to kill every last moa in some of the world's most rugged terrain, and only a few centuries to differentiate into a range of diverse societies, from that of coastal hunter-gatherers to that of farmers practicing new types of food storage. Our archaeologists might therefore look at the Americas and conclude that Africans, despite their apparently enormous head start, would have been overtaken by the earliest Americans within at most a millennium. Thereafter, the Americas' greater area, 50% greater than Africa's, and much greater environmental diversity, would have given the advantage to Native Americans over Africans. The archaeologists might then turn to Eurasia and reason as follows. Eurasia is the world's largest continent. It has been occupied for longer than any other continent except Africa. Africa's long occupation before the colonization of Eurasia a million years ago might have counted for nothing anyway, because proto-humans were at such a primitive stage then. Our archaeologists might look at the upper Paleolithic flowering of southwestern Europe between 20,000 and 12,000 years ago, with all those famous artworks and complex tools, and wonder whether Eurasia was already getting a head start then, at least locally. Finally, the archaeologist would turn to Australia, New Guinea, noting first its small area, it's the smallest continent, the largest fraction of it covered by desert capable of supporting few humans, the continent's isolation, and its later occupation than that of Africa and Eurasia. All that might lead the archaeologist to predict slow development in Australia, New Guinea. But remember that Australians and New Guineans had by far the earliest watercraft in the world. They were creating cave paintings, apparently at least as early as the Cro-Magnons in Europe. Jonathan Kingdon and Tim Flannery have noted that the colonization of Australia and New Guinea from the islands of the Asian continental shelf required humans to learn to deal with the new environments they encountered on the islands of central Indonesia, a maze of coastlines offering the richest marine resources, coral reefs, and mangroves in the world. As the colonists crossed the strait separating each Indonesian island from the next one to the east, they adapted anew, filled up that next island, and went on to colonize the next island again. It was a hitherto unprecedented golden age of successive human population explosions. Perhaps those cycles of colonization, adaptation, and population explosion were what selected for the Great Leap Forward, which then diffused back westward to Eurasia and Africa. If this scenario is correct, then Australia and New Guinea gained a massive head start that might have continued to propel human development there long after the Great Leap Forward. Thus, an observer transported back in time to 11,000 BC could not have predicted on which continent human societies would develop most quickly, but could have made a strong case for any of the continents. With hindsight, of course, we know that Eurasia was the one, but it turns out that the actual reasons behind the more rapid development of Eurasian societies were not at all the straightforward ones that our imaginary archaeologist of 11,000 BC guessed. The remainder of this book consists of a quest to discover those real reasons. Chapter 2, A Natural Experiment of History. On the Chatham Islands, 500 miles east of New Zealand, centuries of independence came to a brutal end for the Moriori people in December 1835. On November 19th of that year, a ship carrying 500 Maori, armed with guns, clubs, and axes, arrived, followed on December 5th by a shipload of 400 more Maori. Groups of Maori began to walk through Moriori settlements, announcing that the Moriori were now their slaves, and killing those who objected. An organized resistance by the Moriori could still then have defeated the Maori, who were outnumbered 2-1. However, the Moriori had a tradition of resolving disputes peacefully. They decided in a council meeting not to fight back, but to offer peace, friendship, and a division of resources. Before the Moriori could deliver that offer, the Maori attacked en masse. Over the course of the next few days, they killed hundreds of Moriori, cooked and ate many of the bodies, and enslaved all the others, killing most of them too over the next few years as it suited their whim. A Moriori survivor recalled, "The Maori commenced to kill us like sheep. We were terrified, fled to the bush, concealed ourselves in holes underground and in any place to escape our enemies. It was of no avail. We were discovered and killed, men, women, and children, indiscriminately." A Maori conqueror explained, "We took possession in accordance with our customs, and we caught all the people. Not one escaped. Some ran away from us, these we killed, and others we killed. But what of that? It was in accordance with our custom." The brutal outcome of this collision between the Moriori and the Maori could have easily been predicted. The Moriori were a small, isolated population of hunter-gatherers equipped with only the simplest technology and weapons, entirely inexperienced at war, and lacking strong leadership or organization. The Maori invaders from New Zealand's North Island came from a dense population of farmers chronically engaged in ferocious wars, equipped with more advanced technology and weapons, and operating under strong leadership. Of course, when the two groups finally came into contact, it was the Maori who slaughtered the Moriori, not vice versa. The tragedy of the Moriori resembles many other such tragedies in both the modern and the ancient world, pitting numerous well-equipped people against few ill-equipped opponents. What makes the Maori-Moriori collision grimly illuminating is that both groups had diverged from a common origin less than a millennium earlier. Both were Polynesian peoples. The modern Maori are descendants of Polynesian farmers who colonized New Zealand around AD 1000. Soon thereafter, a group of those Maori in turn colonized the Chatham Islands and became the Moriori. In the centuries after the two groups separated, they evolved in opposite directions, the North Island Maori developing more complex and the Moriori less complex technology and political organization. The Moriori reverted to being hunter-gatherers, while the North Island Maori turned to more intensive farming. Those opposite evolutionary courses sealed the outcome of their eventual collision. If we could understand the reasons for the disparate developments of those two island societies, we might have a model for understanding the broader question of differing developments on the continents. Moriori and Maori history constitutes a brief, small-scale natural experiment that tests how environments affect human societies. Before you read a whole book examining environmental effects on a very large scale, effects on human societies around the world for the last 13,000 years, you might reasonably want assurance from smaller tests that such effects really are significant. If you were a laboratory scientist studying rats, you might perform such a test by taking one rat colony, distributing groups of those ancestral rats among many cages with differing environments, and coming back many rat generations later to see what had happened. Of course, such purposeful experiments cannot be carried out on human societies. Instead, scientists must look for natural experiments in which something similar befell humans in the past. Such an experiment unfolded during the settlement of Polynesia. Scattered over the Pacific Ocean, beyond New Guinea and Melanesia, are thousands of islands differing greatly in area, isolation, elevation, climate, productivity, and geological and biological resources. For most of human history, Those islands lay far beyond the reach of watercraft. Around 1200 BC, a group of farming, fishing, seafaring people from the Bismarck Archipelago, north of New Guinea, finally succeeded in reaching some of those islands. Over the following centuries, their descendants colonized virtually every habitable scrap of land in the Pacific. The process was mostly complete by AD 500, with the last few islands settled around or soon after AD 1000. Thus, within a modest time span, enormously diverse island environments were settled by colonists, all of whom stemmed from the same founding population. The ultimate ancestors of all modern Polynesian populations shared essentially the same culture, language, technology, and set of domesticated plants and animals. Hence, Polynesian history constitutes a natural experiment, allowing us to study human adaptation devoid of the usual complications of multiple waves of disparate colonists that often frustrates our attempts to understand adaptation elsewhere in the world. Within that medium-sized test, the fate of the Moriori forms a smaller test. It is easy to trace how the differing environments of the Chatham Islands and of New Zealand molded the Moriori and the Maori differently. While those ancestral Maori who first colonized the Chathams may have been farmers, Maori tropical crops could not grow in the Chatham's cold climate, and the colonists had no alternative except to revert to being hunter-gatherers. Since as hunter-gatherers, they did not produce crop surpluses available for redistribution or storage, they could not support and feed non-hunting craft specialists, armies, bureaucrats, and chiefs. Their prey were seals, shellfish, nesting seabirds, and fish that could be captured by hand or with clubs and required no more elaborate technology. In addition, the Chathams are relatively small and remote islands, capable of supporting a total population of only about 2,000 hunter-gatherers. With no other accessible islands to colonize, the Moriori had to remain in the Chathams and to learn how to get along with each other. They did so by renouncing war, and they reduced potential conflicts from overpopulation by castrating some male infants. The result was a small, unwarlike population with simple technology and weapons and without strong leadership or organization. In contrast, the northern, warmer part of New Zealand, by far the largest island group in Polynesia, was suitable for Polynesian agriculture. Those Maori who remained in New Zealand increased in numbers until there were more than 100,000 of them. They developed locally dense populations, chronically engaged in ferocious wars with neighboring populations. With the crop surpluses that they could grow and store, they fed craft specialists, chiefs, and part-time soldiers. They needed and developed varied tools for growing their crops, fighting, and making art. They erected elaborate ceremonial buildings and prodigious numbers of forts. Thus, Moriori and Maori societies developed from the same ancestral society, but along very different lines. The resulting two societies lost awareness even of each other's existence, and did not come into contact again for many centuries, for perhaps as long as 500 years. Finally, an Australian seal hunting ship visiting the Chathams en route to New Zealand brought the news to New Zealand of islands where there is an abundance of sea and shellfish. The lakes swarm with eels, and it is a land of the karaka berry. The inhabitants are very numerous, but they do not understand how to fight and have no weapons. That news was enough to induce 900 Maori to sail to the Chathams. The outcome clearly illustrates how environments can affect economy, technology, political organization, and fighting skills within a short time. As I already mentioned, the Maori-Moriori collision represents a small test within a medium-sized test. What can we learn from all of Polynesia about environmental influences on human society? What differences among societies on different Polynesian islands need to be explained? Polynesia as a whole presented a much wider range of environmental conditions than did just New Zealand and the Chathams, although the latter define one extreme, the simple end of Polynesian organization. In their subsistence modes, Polynesians ranged from the hunter-gatherers of the Chathams through slash-and-burn farmers to practitioners of intensive food production living at some of the highest population densities of any human society. Polynesian food producers variously intensified production of pigs, dogs, and chickens. They organized workforces to construct large irrigation systems for agriculture and to enclose large ponds for fish production. The economic basis of Polynesian societies consisted of more or less self-sufficient households, but some islands also supported guilds of hereditary part-time craft specialists. In social organization, Polynesian societies ran the gamut from fairly egalitarian village societies to some of the most stratified societies in the world, with many hierarchically ranged lineages and with chief and commoner classes whose members married within their own class. In political organization, Polynesian islands ranged from landscapes divided into independent tribal or village units up to multi-island proto-empires that devoted standing military establishments to invasions of other islands and wars of conquest. Finally, Polynesian material culture varied from the production of no more than personal utensils to the construction of monumental stone architecture. How can all that variation be explained? Contributing to these differences among Polynesian societies were at least six sets of environmental variables among Polynesian islands: island climate, geological type, marine resources, area, terrain fragmentations, and isolation. Let's examine the ranges of these factors before considering their specific consequences for Polynesian societies. The climate in Polynesia varies from warm tropical or subtropical on most islands, which lie near the equator, to temperate on most of New Zealand, and cold subantarctic on the Chathams and the southern part of New Zealand's South Island. Hawaii's Big Island, though lying well within the Tropic of Cancer, has mountains high enough to support alpine habitats and receive occasional snowfalls. Rainfall varies from the highest recorded on Earth in New Zealand's Fiordland and Hawaii's Alakai Swamp on Kauai to only one-tenth as much on islands so dry that they are marginal for agriculture. Island geological types include coral atolls, raised limestone, volcanic islands, pieces of continents, and mixtures of those types. At one extreme, innumerable islets, such as those of the Tuamotu Archipelago, are flat, low atolls barely rising above sea level. Other former atolls, such as Henderson and Rennell, have been lifted far above sea level to constitute raised limestone islands. Both of those atoll types present problems to human settlers, because they consist entirely of limestone without other stones, have only very thin soil, and lack permanent fresh water. At the opposite extreme, the largest Polynesian island, New Zealand, is an old, geologically diverse continental fragment of Gondwana land, offering a range of mineral resources, including commercially exploitable iron, coal, gold, and jade. Most other large Polynesian islands are volcanoes that rose from the sea, have never formed part of a continent, and may or may not include areas of raised limestone. While lacking New Zealand's geological richness, the oceanic volcanic islands, at least, are an improvement over atolls from the Polynesian's perspective, in that they offer diverse types of volcanic stones, some of which are highly suitable for making stone tools. The volcanic islands differ among themselves. The elevations of the higher ones generate rain in the mountains, so the islands are heavily weathered and have deep soils and permanent streams. That is true, for instance, of the Societies, Samoa, the Marquesas, and especially Hawaii, the Polynesian archipelago with the highest mountains. Among the lower islands, Tonga, and to a lesser extent, Easter, also have rich soil because of volcanic ash falls, but they lack Hawaii's large streams. As for marine resources, most Polynesian islands are surrounded by shallow water and reefs, and many also encompass lagoons. Those environments teem with fish and shellfish. However, the rocky coasts of Easter, Pitcairn, and the Marquesas, and the steeply dropping ocean bottom and absence of coral reefs around those islands are much less productive of seafood. Area is another obvious variable. Ranging from the 100 acres of Anuta, the smallest permanently inhabited isolated Polynesian island, up to the 103,000 square miles of the mini-continent of New Zealand. The habitable terrain of some islands, notably the Marquesas, is fragmented into steep-walled valleys by ridges, while other islands, such as Tonga and Easter, consist of gently rolling terrain presenting no obstacles to travel and communication. The last environmental variable to consider is isolation. Easter Island and the Chathams are small, and so remote from other islands that once they were initially colonized, the societies thus founded developed in total isolation from the rest of the world. New Zealand, Hawaii, and the Marquesas also are very remote, but at least the latter two apparently did have some further contact with other archipelagos after the first colonization. And all three consist of many islands close enough to each other for regular contact between islands of the same archipelago. Most other Polynesian islands were in more or less regular contact with other islands. In particular, the Tongan archipelago lies close enough to the Fijian, Samoan, and Wallace archipelagos to have permitted regular voyaging between archipelagos, and eventually to permit Tongans to undertake the conquest of Fiji. After that brief look at Polynesia's varying environments, let's now see how that variation influenced Polynesian societies. Subsistence is a convenient facet of society with which to start, since it in turn affected other facets. Polynesian subsistence depended on varying mixes of fishing, gathering wild plants and marine shellfish and crustacea, hunting terrestrial birds and breeding seabirds, and food production. Most Polynesian islands originally supported big flightless birds that had evolved in the absence of predators, New Zealand's moas and Hawaii's flightless geese being the best known examples. While those birds were important food sources for the initial colonists, especially on New Zealand's South Island, most of them were soon exterminated on all islands because they were easy to hunt down. Breeding seabirds were also quickly reduced in number, but continued to be important food sources on some islands. Marine resources were significant on most islands, but least so on Easter, Pitcairn, and the Marquesas, where people, as a result, were especially dependent on food that they themselves produced. Ancestral Polynesians brought with them three domesticated animals, the pig, chicken, and dog, and domesticated no other animals within Polynesia. Many islands retained all three of those species, but the more isolated Polynesian islands lacked one or more of them, either because livestock brought in canoes failed to survive the colonists' long overwater journey, or because livestock that died out could not be readily obtained again from the outside. For instance, isolated New Zealand ended up with only dogs, Easter and Tikopia with only chickens. Without access to coral reefs or productive shallow waters, and with their terrestrial birds quickly exterminated, Easter Islanders turned to constructing chicken houses for intensive poultry farming. At best, however, these three domesticated animal species provided only occasional meals. Polynesian food production depended mainly on agriculture, which was impossible at sub-Antarctic latitudes because all Polynesian crops were tropical ones, initially domesticated outside Polynesia and brought in by colonists. The settlers of the Chathams and the cold southern part of New Zealand's South Island were thus forced to abandon the farming legacy developed by their ancestors over the previous thousands of years and to become hunter-gatherers again. People on the remaining Polynesian islands did practice agriculture based on dryland crops, especially taro, yams, and sweet potatoes, irrigated crops, mainly taro, and tree crops such as breadfruit, bananas, and coconuts. The productivity and relative importance of those crop types varied considerably on different islands, depending on their environments. Human population densities were lowest on Henderson, Rennell, and the atolls because of their poor soil and limited fresh water. Densities were also low on temperate New Zealand, which was too cool for some Polynesian crops. Polynesians on these and some other islands practiced a non-intensive type of shifting-slash-and-burn agriculture. Other islands had rich soils, but were not high enough to have large permanent streams and hence irrigation. Inhabitants of those islands developed intensive dryland agriculture, requiring a heavy input of labor to build terraces, carry out mulching, rotate crops, reduce or eliminate fallow periods, and maintain tree plantations. Dryland agriculture became especially productive on Easter, Tiny Anuta, and Flat and Low Tonga, where Polynesians developed most of the land area to the growing of food. The most productive Polynesian agriculture was taro cultivation in irrigated fields. Among the more populous tropical islands, that option was ruled out for Tonga by its low elevation and hence its lack of rivers. Irrigation agriculture reached its peak on the westernmost Hawaiian islands of Kauai, Oahu, and Molokai, which were big and wet enough to support not only large permanent streams, but also large human populations available for construction projects. Hawaiian labor corvées built elaborate irrigation systems for taro fields, yielding up to 24 tons per acre, the highest crop yields in all of Polynesia. Those yields, in turn, supported intensive pig production. Hawaii was also unique within Polynesia in using mass labor for aquaculture by constructing large fish ponds in which milkfish and mullet were grown. As a result of all this environmentally related variation in subsistence, human population densities measured in people per square mile of arable land varied greatly over Polynesia. At the lower end were the hunter-gatherers of the Chathams, only 5 people per square mile, and of New Zealand's South Island and the farmers of the rest of New Zealand, 28 people per square mile. In contrast, many islands with intensive agriculture attained population densities exceeding 120 per square mile. Tonga, Samoa, and the Societies achieved 210 to 250 people per square mile, and Hawaii, 300. The upper extreme of 1,100 people per square mile was reached on the island of Anuta, whose population converted essentially all the land to intensive food production, thereby crammed 160 people into the island's 100 acres, and joined the ranks of the densest self-sufficient populations in the world. Anuta's population density exceeded that of modern Holland, and even rivaled that of Bangladesh. Population size is the product of population density, people per square mile, and area, square miles. The relevant area is not the area of an island, but that of a political unit, which could be either larger or smaller than a single island. On the one hand, islands near one another might become combined into a single political unit. On the other hand, single large rugged islands were divided into many independent political units. Hence, the area of the political unit varied not only with an island's area, but also with its fragmentation and isolation. For small, isolated islands without strong barriers to internal communication, the entire island constituted the political unit, as in the case of Anuta with its 160 people. Many larger islands never did become unified politically, whether because the population consisted of dispersed bands of only a few dozen hunter-gatherers each, the Chathams and New Zealand's southern South Island, or of farmers scattered over large distances, the rest of New Zealand, or of farmers living in dense populations but in rugged terrain, precluding political unification. For example, people in neighboring steep-sided valleys of the Marquesas communicated with each other mainly by sea. Each valley formed an independent political entity of a few thousand inhabitants, and most individual large Marquesan islands remained divided into many such entities. The terrains of the Tongan, Samoan, Society, and Hawaiian Islands did permit political unification within islands, yielding political units of 10,000 people or more, over 30,000 on the large Hawaiian Islands. The distances between islands of the Tongan archipelago, as well as the distances between Tonga and neighboring archipelagos, were sufficiently modest that a multi-island empire encompassing 40,000 people was eventually established. Thus, Polynesian political units ranged in size from a few dozen to 40,000 people. A political unit's population size interacted with its population density to influence Polynesian technology and economic, social, and political organization. In general, the larger the size and the higher the density, the more complex and specialized were the technology and organization, for reasons that we shall examine in detail in later chapters. Briefly, at high population densities, only a portion of the people came to be farmers, but they were mobilized to devote themselves to intensive food production, thereby yielding surpluses to feed non-producers. The non-producers mobilizing them included chiefs, priests, bureaucrats, and warriors. The biggest political units could assemble large labor forces to construct irrigation systems and fish ponds that intensified food production even further. These developments were especially apparent on Tonga, Samoa, and the Societies, all of which were fertile, densely populated, and moderately large by Polynesian standards. The trends reached their zenith on the Hawaiian archipelago, consisting of the largest tropical Polynesian islands, where high population densities and large land areas meant that very large labor forces were potentially available to individual chiefs. The variations among Polynesian societies associated with different population densities and sizes were as follows. Economies remained simplest on islands with low population densities, such as the hunter-gatherers of the Chathams, low population numbers, small atolls, or both low densities and low numbers. In those societies, each household made what it needed. There was little or no economic specialization. Specialization increased on larger, more densely populated islands, reaching a peak on Samoa, the societies, and especially Tonga and Hawaii. The latter two islands supported hereditary part-time craft specialists, including canoe builders, navigators, stonemasons, bird catchers, and tattooers. Social complexity was similarly varied. Again, the Chathams and the Atolls had the simplest, most egalitarian societies. While those islands retained the original Polynesian tradition of having chiefs, their chiefs wore little or no visible signs of distinction, lived in ordinary huts like those of commoners, and grew or caught their food like everyone else. Social distinctions and chiefly powers increased on high-density islands, with large political units being especially marked on Tonga and the societies. Social complexity again reached its peak in the Hawaiian archipelago, where people of chiefly descent were divided into 8 hierarchically ranked lineages. Members of those chiefly lineages did not intermarry with commoners, but only with each other, sometimes even with siblings or half-siblings. Commoners had to prostrate themselves before high-ranking chiefs. All the members of chiefly lineages, bureaucrats, and some craft specialists were freed from the work of food production. Political organization followed the same trends. On the Chathams and Atolls, the chiefs had few resources to command. Decisions were reached by general discussion, and land ownership rested with the community as a whole rather than with the chiefs. Larger, more densely populated political units concentrated more authority with the chiefs. Political complexity was greatest on Tonga and Hawaii, where the powers of hereditary chiefs approximated those of kings elsewhere in the world, and where land was controlled by the chiefs, not by the commoners. Using appointed bureaucrats as agents, chiefs requisitioned food from the commoners and also conscripted them to work on large construction projects whose form varied from island to island. Irrigation projects and fish ponds on Hawaii, dance and feast centers on the Marquesas, chiefs' tombs on Tonga, and temples on Hawaii, the societies, and Easter. At the time of Europeans' arrival in the 18th century, the Tongan chiefdom, or state, had already become an inter-archipelagal empire. Because the Tongan archipelago itself was geographically close-knit and included several large islands with unfragmented terrain, each island became unified under a single chief. Then the hereditary chiefs of the largest Tongan island, Tongatapu, united the whole archipelago, and eventually they conquered islands outside the archipelago up to 500 miles distant. They engaged in regular long-distance trade with Fiji and Samoa, established Tongan settlements in Fiji, and began to raid and conquer parts of Fiji. The conquest and administration of this maritime proto-empire were achieved by navies of large canoes, each holding up to 150 men. Like Tonga, Hawaii became a political entity encompassing several populous islands, but one confined to a single archipelago because of its extreme isolation. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.